This talk was recorded by Insight Meditation South Bay in Mountain View, California. For more talks and information, visit www.imsb.org.
This is the second time I've been asked to give a talk here. And before I begin, let me ask, are there people here who've never been here before? Do you know anything about Buddhism? Are you new to Buddhism as well? Yes? I ask because I'm an academic. So there you go, sorry. And so when someone asks me to teach on a topic, I do, you know, I have so much fun preparing. It's so much fun. I've had such a great time preparing this talk. I don't know if you've noticed, but the wisdom section of the Anuruddha Sutta, the Sutta on the Great Eight Thoughts, is the shortest. It's about this big. And I told a monk friend of mine, and he said, "Why do you think they gave you the shortest one?" And I said, "Well, it is on wisdom. That's got to count for something." So anyway, so this was my thing in graduate school, too. Every time they would assign me to write a paper, I would spend, you know, 4 months of the semester researching the paper because I loved doing the research. And I learned Pali. I'm a classicist by training, so I do ancient Greek and Latin language and literature. And I learned Pali some years ago so that I could translate the Terigata, which are the poems of the first Buddhist nuns. And so I'm certainly not fluent, but I can read it with a dictionary. So, of course, I had to go back and read all the suttas on wisdom in Pali, and then so I could understand. So anyway, I'm only going to give you a little bit of Pali, but I have a good reason for it, which I'm going to tell you in a second. Those of you who don't know anything about Buddhism and that this is a talk on a particular sutta in the Buddhist teachings, I think actually this is going to cover a lot of fundamental teachings about the Buddha, but it's going to be probably from a particular academic kind of angle. So I'm happy to entertain questions after the fact. So one of the reasons that I do spend quite a bit of time looking at the Pali and then going back and understanding why something is translated a certain way is because all translations are basic paraphrases. Right? They just are paraphrases. It's the best we can do. So, for example, a concrete noun, let's say vehicle, so we can vehicle. If I say the word vehicle, something comes to mind for you. Right? So you, a car, a motorcycle, something. But, of course, at the time that these suttas were written down, the word vehicle would invoke something completely different, right? I mean, they didn't have the word vehicle, but the word that was vehicle would invoke a completely different image. So when we're translating, any translation works on that. And if you know another language, people in here know other languages, speak other languages, so you know how that works. Constantly. So you can imagine if there's a different definition for a concrete noun like vehicle, that abstract nouns, things like words for enlightenment, wisdom, compassion, suffering, these are all abstract. These aren't things we can reach out and touch, right? They're abstract nouns. So we have words. I mean, this word, for example, dukkha, it gets translated in various ways, suffering, Tan Jeff calls it stress. Different people have different, you know, pain, dissatisfaction. None of those are wrong, but, you know, if we were going to try to cover everything that dukkha implied, we'd never get to the second noble truth, right, because that's the first noble truth. So the point is that, so part of what I want to do in this talk tonight is talk about the wisdom section, but in order to get there, what I'm going to do is kind of work my way through a few of the other suttas on wisdom. And occasionally I'll stop and talk about a particular word and why it's understood this particular way and in different ways that it might be understood. So, and if we, I'll be happy to take questions. I guess probably at the end might be easiest to do so, but then, or discussion, don't have to ask me anything. In Buddhism, we are taught that wisdom arises after following the Noble Eightfold Path. That in following the Noble Eightfold Path, we develop wisdom. So the Noble Eightfold Path, of course, is divided into three sections, which is always a little bit confusing to people because one of the sections is Panya, which is translated as wisdom. But for the sake of tonight, we'll call that little w wisdom, not capital W. Sila, which is ethical behavior, and samadhi, which is meditation. The Noble Eightfold Path as a path to capital W wisdom is described in three stages. So Panya, or the wisdom that divides the first stage, is a path factor. That's what we call it. It's a path factor. And it's often translated as discernment as well. And it includes view and intention. The word view is thought of and talked about by Buddhist scholars as being both, there's two different kinds. There's mundane view, and then there's superior view, and this will become important as we move into the Anuruddha Sutta. Intention, the Buddha explains, is threefold: the intention of renunciation, of goodwill, and of harmlessness. So we hear these things often with right in front of it, right? Right intention, right view, right I guess that's as far as I've gotten. Sama, which is the word that gets translated as right, is actually an adverb. So it would be better, it would be more accurate in our language to say rightly, right? We've all learned that. Adverbs have ly. Other ways of translating this word, though, sama, it means skillful, wholesome, and it can denote completion, as in something that you've accomplished or is perfected. So the next section is sila, or ethical conduct, and it is the training in moral discipline where we learn to restrain an unwholesome speech and action and prevent defilements from reaching the stage of transgression. Skillful speech, action, and livelihood, and we often refer to that as purity of body, speech, and mind. And then we have samadhi, or meditation, which includes skillful, the three under samadhi are skillful effort, mindfulness, and concentration. So effort is a very important topic, but I'm not going to go into it. Effort is something I'm sure if you've been meditating for any period of time, you know that most of us probably err on the side of too little. But if you push on the side of too much, you can then kind of, it makes you almost want to do too little. So it's really finding that balance of effort, but it's a very important part of the Eightfold Noble Path and of all the factors towards enlightenment. Mindfulness is awareness of the present moment without conceptual elaboration. And I believe that next week Jennifer is going to talk to you about conceptual elaboration, also known as papancha. The mind, so this is a really wonderful example that's given. The mind without mindfulness is sometimes compared to a pumpkin. I just love that. The mind established in mindfulness is a stone. Why is it compared to a pumpkin? A pumpkin placed on the surface of a pond soon floats away and always remains on the water's surface. Can't you just see it? You know how you, little kids, you call them little pumpkins, you know, the little heads look like little pumpkin, little fat pumpkins. You know, you just put it on the water and it just goes floating away. You know, it has this, it's hollow. But stone doesn't float away. A stone, in fact, sinks to its depth. Concentration collects to together the ordinary dispersed and dissipated stream of mental states to create an inner unification. It is an unbroken attentiveness resulting in the tranquility of mental factors. So something to put effort into. From the practice of the Noble Eightfold Path arises the acquired or developed factors of wisdom, with a capital W, and liberation. So these arise, they are conditioned by the Eightfold Noble Path. And according to the text, this is the goal of following the Eightfold Noble Path. And it requires, in order to do that, superior right view. So remember, there was mundane right view. And superior right view is directed seeing into the real nature of phenomena. So remember, I'm building up here to the sutta of the Eight Great Thoughts in the section on wisdom. Superior right view, a direct seeing into the real nature of phenomena, previously grasped only conceptually. And true wisdom, panya, which is a penetrating vision of phenomena in its rising and passing away. So one of the reasons I like to look at these words more closely is things like rising and passing away, these kind of terms come to us so easily, right? You get served a plate of pancakes and then you eat them. That's, you know, rising and passing away, right? It's impermanent. But this isn't that kind of rising and passing away that's being referred to here. It's the penetrating vision of phenomena in its rising and passing away. As we know from the sutta on the setting in motion, the wheel of the Dhamma, the Buddha says that he awakened to the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, and this Eightfold Noble Path. What is the noble truth of suffering? And this is a quote that is often heard from the Pali Canon. Birth is suffering, aging is suffering, illness is suffering, death is suffering, union with what is displeasing is suffering, separation from what is pleasing is suffering, not to get what one wants is suffering. In brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. The five aggregates of subject to clinging. So these are known as the khandhas in Pali, skandhas in Sanskrit. And the five aggregates are a particular way that the Buddha describes how we are constituted. So in Buddhism, you know, the self is not solid. It's a process. We're all just walking verbs. Just to let you know that, if you're a grammar freak like I am. We're just verbs. We're just verbing right along with a few adverbs thrown in sometimes. These five aggregates constitute what or who we think we are, defined as the sensorial aggregates which condition the appearance of life in any form. Just making sense so far? Are you with me? The five aggregates are, I'm going to say the Pali and then give you the English, rupa, which is the material quality, so the body, anything solid is rupa. Vedana, which are feelings, and in this definition, feelings of pleasure, displeasure, or neutral feelings. So what are we attracted to? Pleasure, of course. Sanya, which is perception. Sanya is just pure perception, no overlay, you're just seeing pink, blue, turquoise, just seeing. Sankara, which is a coefficient of consciousness or fabrications. So sankara is, it arises along with the fifth, which is vijnana, which is consciousness. So consciousness comes together with objects and we fabricate from there, right? So we perceive, we begin to think. That's, you know, I look out, there's this group of people, you know, that's the perception. And then the consciousness rises on and I think, oh, she's got such beautiful white hair, I should just stop coloring mine. right? That's what we do. We just fabricate. And this is what constitutes a person. It's not, we're not, as we know, we're not a permanent structure. There was a time before we existed, and there'll be a time after, and we will decompose. So this will come up as we move through the Anuruddha Sutta. It's a very important part of the Buddhist teachings. The Buddha himself went through stages of awakening. The sutta says, he says, "So long, bhikkhus, as my knowledge and vision of these four noble truths, as they really are in their three phases and 12 aspects, were not thoroughly purified, I did not claim to have awakened to the unsurpassed perfect enlightenment. But when my knowledge and vision of the four noble truths, as they really are in their three phases and 12 aspects, was thoroughly purified in this way, then I claimed to have awakened to the unsurpassed perfection of enlightenment." So clearly, what the world considers wisdom and what the Buddha calls wisdom are very different things. Right? So we know that. So the 12 aspects, of course, is what the Buddha wants us to do, and I'll just use the first one as an example, but dukkha. So there's three things we need to know about dukkha. Right? We need to understand that something is dukkha. You know, I don't know, you know, I'm going to use a really mundane example. Let's say my shoes are too tight. I couldn't think of a better one. I'm sorry, I really tried. My shoes are too tight. So I understand that suffering. Then I understand. So I know that the suffering. Then I understand the suffering. Well, the suffering is that it's discomfort. It hurts. There's pinching when I walk. And then there's the understanding of the ceasing of suffering, which in this case might be to take off the shoes. But the three aspects, so when we talk about the Four Noble Truths of suffering, the cause of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the Eightfold Noble Path that leads to the cessation of suffering, it's important to know all three aspects of each one of those to understand what each one is the very important part of growth out of the being stuck in them. So this being a gradual path, we are developing this true wisdom as we go. So in another sutta, the Wisdom Sutta, the Buddha teaches his monks the eight causes and conditions that lead to the obtaining of wisdom. So we'll look at the causes and conditions. So we know that there's suffering and we have the Eightfold Noble Path. So causes and conditions, and what were the ones that the Buddha taught his monks, who he calls bhikkhus. So I'm going to use that because that's what's in the text. We could say bhikkhunis. Maybe I'll say bhikkhunis. That means the nuns. A bhikkhuni lives in dependence on the teacher or a certain fellow bhikkhuni in the position of a teacher, toward whom he or she has set up a keen sense of moral shame or dread and has affection and reverence. This is the first cause and condition that leads to obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the spiritual life. So having a teacher that you both respect, you respect their opinion of you and what you're doing, and you feel a closeness, a trust, and an affection from them. The second cause and condition, this bhikkhuni approaches the teacher from time to time and inquires, "How is this, Bhante? What is this meaning of this? How do I make myself sit after a busy day at work? I don't understand." And the Venerable One then discloses to him or her what has not been disclosed. He discloses what has not been disclosed, clears up what is obscure, and dispels the perplexity about numerous perplexing points. So that's why we go to Dharma talks, right? Because we have questions. We want to do a day long and hopefully meditate and maybe have an interview and get some things cleared up. The third is, having heard the Dhamma, he resorts to two kinds of withdrawal: withdrawal in the body and withdrawal in the mind. This is the third cause and condition. So, of course, what he's referring to is giving yourself time to meditate. And as I pointed out in the sitting practice, there's the physical withdrawal, which we can do when we go on meditation retreat, if we can have some quiet. And then there's the withdrawal internally, when we have no opportunity to be away from sound, but we can still go in and we can still be quiet. We can still practice what we've been taught. The fourth one is, he is virtuous. He dwells restrained by the Padimokkha. Those are the rules, the precepts, 227, that the Buddhist monks take. Possessed of good conduct and resort, seeing danger in minute, in good conduct and resort, and sees danger in minute faults. Having undertaken the training rules, he trains in them. He has learned much, remembers what he has learned, accumulates what he has learned, those teachings that are good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end, and the right meaning and phrasing, which proclaim the perfectly complete and pure life, such teachings as these he has learned much of and retained. So he is virtuous and he remembers what he's taught. He has aroused energy for abandoning and unwholesome qualities and acquiring wholesome qualities. So this is a cause and condition. In the midst of the Sangha, he does not engage in gossip, rambling, or pointless talk. Either he himself speaks on the Dharma, or he requests someone else to do so, or he adopts noble silence. That's a good one for just about everybody everywhere. And then the eighth one, the eighth cause and condition, which is again is relevant to our topic here, he dwells contemplating arising and vanishing in the five aggregate subjects to clinging. So these are the khandhas. This is what he's contemplating. Such is form, such its origin, such its passing away, such is feeling, such is perception, such is volitional activities, such is consciousness, such is its origin and its passing away. This is the eighth cause and condition that leads to obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the spiritual life when it has not been obtained, and to increase its maturation when it has been obtained, and to further development. And I wanted to read something out of the Samyutta. This is the Buddha talking about the four things to develop. These four things, when developed and cultivated, lead to the extensiveness of wisdom, to the vastness of wisdom, to the depth of wisdom, to the state of unequaled wisdom, to the breadth of wisdom, to abundance of wisdom, to quickness of wisdom, to buoyancy of wisdom, to joyousness of wisdom, to swiftness of wisdom, to sharpness of wisdom, to penetrativeness of wisdom. What for? Association with superior persons, hearing the true Dhamma, careful attention and practice in accord with the Dhamma. These four things, when developed and cultivated, lead to the penetration of wisdom. It's a lot of wisdom. So now we can turn to the Sutta of the Eight Great Thoughts. But just to show you what a nerd I am, I actually counted the number of times the Buddha uses the term panya, a wisdom, in the six books of the Pali Canon. So all of them except the Abhidhamma. And he uses the word panya for wisdom 3,048 times. Sati, mindfulness, which is now ubiquitous, he only uses 2,663 times. We probably use that, it's probably on television that many times a day now. And jhana, the meditative absorption, 1,882 times. So clearly, wisdom has won the count in my very informal count there. So for those of you who don't know the Anuruddha Sutta, I'm going to do a refresher just in this brief section so that you can be introduced to our main character, who is a wonderful character in the Pali Canon, in fact. And there are great stories about him. He was the Buddha's cousin as well. So Anuruddha has, as we just went through, he's learned these causes and conditions, no doubt, the ones that the Buddha recommends for the development of wisdom. The sutta opens with the Venerable Anuruddha alone in seclusion when a course of seven thoughts arise in his mind. And these are the seven. The Dhamma is for one with few desires, not for one with strong desires. The Dhamma is for one who is content, not for one who is discontent. This Dhamma is for one who resorts to solitude, not for one who delights in company. This Dhamma is for one who is energetic, not for one who is lazy. This Dhamma is for one with mindfulness established, not for one who is muddle-minded. And just think of the pumpkin kind of floating away, right? That's the muddle-minded. This Dhamma is for one who is concentrated, not for one who is unconcentrated. And then the seventh one, which is where I'm going to stop, this Dhamma is for one who is wise, not one, for one who is unwise. This is the thoughts that are going through Anuruddha's mind while he's on retreat. The Buddha, in his omniscience, knows what Anuruddha is thinking, and he comes to encourage him and to add the eighth thought. The Buddha tells him that during the next rains retreat, he is to go into seclusion and practice moving through the jhanas, the states of meditative absorption, which is all I'll say about them here, but most of you probably know the jhanas or know of the jhanas. And he says this, the Buddha says, when, Anuruddha, you reflect on these eight thoughts of a great person, then, as much as you wish, secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, you will enter and dwell in the first jhana, which consists of rapture and pleasure born of seclusion, accompanied by thought and examination, vitaka, vichara. Then you'll move to the second jhana, which has internal placidity, so it's your calm, and the unification of mind, and consists of rapture, pleasure, born of concentration, without thought and examination. The third jhana, of which the noble ones declare, he is equanimous, mindful, one who dwells happily. In the fourth jhana, neither painful nor pleasant, which has purification of mindfulness by equanimity. Saying this, then, the Buddha describes what this practice will bring about at this time for Anuruddha while he's in seclusion. He says it will transform his perception from the mundane to the supramundane. He says he will, after practicing these four jhanas, he will perceive that the scraps of alms food in his bowl, so he's been, you know, he has a bowl and who knows what he has in it, but he'll perceive it as a feast, a glorious feast. And he will perceive the root of the tree where he lives to seem like a house with a roof and walls. And his straw mat will appear like a couch spread with rugs and blankets. And his medicine of fermented cow's urine will seem as various ghee, butter, oil, honey, molasses, and all. And, here's the important part, will serve for your delight, relief and ease, and for entering upon nibbana. So the states of blissful perception are not ends in themselves. They create a pleasurable state for the ground of awakening for entering nibbana. Does that make sense? So he's working his way through these jhanas, and from this state of pleasure, perceiving the beauty that is his medicinal cow urine, but seeing it as something else, from that state, that exalted state, is where he will move into nibbana. The Buddha leaves Anuruddha to practice, and he goes back to his bhikkhus, his monks, and he explains to them each of these states. For the sake of tonight's topic, though, we will look closely at number seven. So the Buddha asked them, when it was said, this Dhamma is for one who is wise, not for one who is unwise, with reference to what was it said? That was a rhetorical question because he's about to tell them. He says, here, a bhikkhu is wise. He possesses the wisdom that discerns arising and passing away, which is noble and penetrative and leads to the complete destruction of suffering. When it is said, the Dhamma is for one who is wise, not for one who is unwise, it is with reference to that it was said, So, what is wisdom? It is the wisdom that discerns the rising and passing away. Again, to point out that, you know, this is where my philologist self kind of gets very excited and wants to understand what the Pali actually says. So, of course, I had to do that. And I think you might be interested. I won't spend much time on it. But what he is saying here, to repeat, a bhikkhu is wise. He possesses the wisdom that discerns arising and passing away, which is noble and penetrative and leads to the complete destruction of suffering. So here, a bhikkhu is wise, and the Pali for that is panyava, which actually means endowed with wisdom. And he is possessed with wisdom that discerns arising and passing away. So again, we have the panya again used, so it's a second wisdom. But what's most interesting is this word, the discerns, the passing, the arising and passing away that he discerns. And it is this long compound word, udayatagaman, udayatagaman. So breaking down the compound, udaya, which actually means to grow, to increase, to rise. Ata means to go out of existence, to fade away, to disappear. And gamani is to lead to. So when we say buddham saranam gachami. So it's the same. Gamani is a different person. It's actually a different part of speech. So it is leading to the passing away. He's seeing, he's perceiving clearly the arising and passing away that would lead to birth and death. But of course, it's only birth and death if he's seeing it from mundane view. Right? So if he's seeing it from the supramundane view, or from the transcendental view, or for the superior view, it is simply the rising and passing away. That's what happens, right? To all phenomena. It all arises and it all passes away. So, this is an example of the two different forms of view. The view that suffers, right? And then the view that sees all phenomena as arising and passing. And how does he see it? He sees it with Arya Nibbidikaya, which is noble and penetrative. Noble insight, literally piercing or penetrating into the khandhas, and leads to the complete destruction of suffering. And this is this really fabulous compound word, which I don't even know if I can say it. It's got so many syllables. Dukkakaya ya gamani ya. So it means leading to the extinction of suffering. So this insight is a direct seeing into the way things are, a penetrating vision that which we think we are. So he is perceiving the rising and passing away of phenomena of the khandhas. That is what it's saying here. The Arya, the noble, Nibbidika Kara, the penetrating into the khandhas. It's possible, you know, to have a direct experience or insight into the rising and passing away of phenomena. It's possible to do it with enough practice. Bhikkhu Bodhi writes, the analysis by way of the five aggregates paves the way for an attempt to see experience solely in terms of its constitutive factors without slipping in implicit references to an unfindable self. So when you perceive the rising and passing away, now remember this is wisdom, right? Capital W. When you perceive the rising and passing away of phenomena, what happens is, the khandhas, what you see is the what he calls the constitutive factors that don't allow for the implicit reference to an unfindable self. That's what happens when you perceive it. That's why it's the capital W wisdom. To gain this perspective requires developing the ability to dwell, contemplating the five aggregates, their arising and passing away. That is the emptiness of the khandhas. So this is not mundane wisdom that the Buddha is referring to here. He is referring to the faculty of wisdom that liberates the mind. The wisdom in the principle is the principal means of awakening. Panya is held as the final accomplishment through which the mind is totally released of kalesa or defilements. And kalesas are the things that make us suffer. Jealousy, hatred, greed, all of that kind of thing. And the kalesas, of course, arise out of the khandhas. So when we purify the khandhas, we purify the kalesa. And how do we purify the khandha? We see that there is no self. We penetrate into the wisdom of the rising and passing away of these constituent parts. The statement which describes this spiritual success of both the Buddha himself and his disciples comes from a sutta called the Greater Lion's Roar. The Buddha, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge the Tathagata, this one such gone, here and now enters upon and abides in the deliverance of mind and the deliverance of wisdom that are without kalesa with the destruction of the kalesa. So I've got one more little reading for you here about the Buddha, its development of wisdom. So some of you have heard of the five faculties of wisdom, and it's the faculties of faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and the faculty of wisdom. And what the Buddha says here about wisdom is, and what bhikkhus is the faculty of wisdom? Here, bhikkhus, the noble disciple is wise. He possesses wisdom directed to arising and passing away, which is noble and penetrative, leading to the complete destruction of suffering. This is called the faculty of wisdom. This wisdom penetrates the nature of phenomena previously grasped only conceptually. So we can, you know, I can say these things. This is the constituent parts of this this process called Nona. That's saying it conceptually, but I can perceive that. I can penetrate into that and see that the elements are there that create this. We all can, right? That's the point here. This is the wisdom that penetrates delusion, not the wisdom that skillfully manages delusion. Managing delusion is not the goal of Buddhism. I mean, we all want to be better people, right, and do things in good ways and be wholesome. But to manage delusion is not the goal of Buddhism. You know, people say things like, oh, you know, I saw this, you know, person calls himself a Buddhist and he was really mad. Not a very good Buddhist if he's really mad. Well, that may be true, but that's not the point of practice, right? The point of practice is not to manage that delusion. Yes, it'd be nice to, you know, get control of our emotions, not get triggered, etc. We all want to do that, and those are good things to do. But that's not the point of Buddhism. So a couple things to finish here. Wisdom arises out of insight, and insight arises out of the stilled and luminous mind. So I will just tell you that I've gone through these different things that can bring awakening, developing the jhanas, the Eightfold Noble Path, the conditions, the causes and conditions, the penetrating of that which isn't real, that which we consider ourselves. And along with that, with the Brahma Viharas, and ridding ourselves of conceit. Very important. And always it comes along with these teachings of the Buddha. I want to tell you a little thing about Anuruddha before I finish and we can open it up. But Anuruddha, I told you that I translated the Terigata, and those are the verses written by the early Buddhist nuns, but there's also the Theragata, which are the verses written by the early Buddhist monks. And of course, these were the original followers of the Buddha. And Anuruddha has a poem there, and I'm not going to read it, I won't read the whole thing at least, but what I will tell you is what he said is that for 55 years, he did not lay down to sleep. He sat in a box. This is one of the ascetic practices that Buddhist monks can do. The Dutanga practices are called. He sat in a box to meditate for 55 years. And he says, which already that's enough, right? But what he's bragging about here is not that. Maybe he's not bragging. But what he's saying here, but for 25 years, I haven't even been drowsy, which I think is really kind of humorous. But and then he talks about himself in this really kind of third-person way, which is what they do, and this is an enlightenment poem. The poised one with steady heart was not breathing. Imperturbable, committed to peace, the seer has realized nibbana. So he wasn't dead there, but he was in such a state of jhana that he was committed to peace and realized nibbana. The Buddha designated Anuruddha as his foremost in divine vision, which is a whole story into itself. He had this divine vision where he could see everything that was going on in the world. So that's what I have for you on wisdom in the sutta. I had to do something. I mean, I only had 6 lines to work with, right? So what was I going to do? So are there questions or discussion about this? I'd love to hear what you think about it. Yes, please.
Thank you for your research talk. But what interested me most was when we were in meditation, you said more than once that the mind seeks pleasure. Why does the mind, and I think that this is true for a lot of us, go to very unpleasurable areas in the course of a day, you know, thinking about family, work. This is not seeking pleasure. This is seeking agitation. And so I'm wondering, does your mind just go for pleasure?
Only. Hardly. So you're asking me why that happens? I mean, I think that, I'm going to give you a really pat answer, so you'll have to forgive me, but this is actually a partial answer. I think the answer is much more complex. But one thing is that we train, the mind is really, they use the metaphor or the analogy of a puppy. The mind is trained, right? It's conditioned. I mean, that's what the whole thing about the causes and conditions. The mind is conditioned. If you were talked critically and abused as a child, you're likely to have even if you don't do that to other people, your internal voice is going to be often critical and mean to you, right? But even if that's not the case, if it's just that you live in our culture where, what's on the news? It's a constant, we're constantly watching, being bombarded with, in every place, this kind of, you're not good enough, nothing's good, whatever it says, whatever the unpleasant says, we all have it. And it's a habit of mind, so that's the short answer. It's a habit of mind arising out of causes and conditions. You know, the word mind is one of those words that it could mean something like that, like what you're talking about, this one that drives us crazy because it's not trained. You know, in the Dhammapada, the Buddha says the trained mind is your best friend, and the untrained mind, you wish you never met it. You know, it's your worst enemy. So, so it takes a long time to train the mind, and it takes continuity. You have to be consistent. And even then, our habits are so old. Depending upon what perspective you're looking at, some people think they go back lifetimes, right? So, but even if it's just this lifetime, we have habits of mind the mind, as you may have noticed, it gets on its little wheel and it just goes. So, but the mind loves pleasure, loves it. You know, why do people drink? Why do they do drugs, eat chocolate, you know, go out for, you know, you just name it, right? We surround ourselves with pleasure. We love pleasure. There's nothing wrong with that. That's part of being a human being. So when you want to train the mind, you give it pleasurable things to train it. And as a, you know, for me and for many people, the breath can be a very pleasant object. So you find where is it pleasant? Where does it feel like velvet or satin or whatever happens for you? And yes, it's not very exciting. So the mind will, you know, oh, and then he said, she said, blah, blah. And then you have to bring it back. But what about this satin here, you know? And over time, you know, it begins to enjoy letting go of that. That's a part of the purification that is necessary. So I'll stop there with that one. Anybody else? Yes, please. Sorry.
What's confusing about it, you said that Buddha helped him in high esteem. And I thought that Buddha finally came to enlightenment when he gave up on the ascetic practices and took the middle way and started taking care of all of it. That's the part that really...
I see. Well, actually, the Buddha gave the monks were allowed 8 ascetic practices, begging from a bowl, the begging bowls, I think not eating after noon, wearing rags, rag robes, not lying down to sleep is one of the ascetic practices. I mean, they're nothing like what the Buddha was doing when he was starving himself and, you know, putting, I don't know, things under his fingernails. I don't know what he did, terrible things to, you know, make himself suffer. It wasn't like that. So they're not that way. But not lying down is actually a technique used not just by Buddhists, but by, you know, Hindu sadhus, you know, you train, it's a way of training the mind. And they do sleep, most likely, sitting up, but it's a way of training the mind to be right there. There's groups of nuns in Tibetan nunneries now. I've seen photographs of them, 300 of them, that live in boxes, and that's what they're doing. The Togdimas, they're called, the yoginis who just practice and in these boxes. It's an austerity, no doubt, but it apparently can be done.
How would the Buddha approach purification if you wanted to make a decision to do that?
To do what? Oh, you mean to go sit in a box? Which was the part? To go sit in a box, you mean?
No.
Oh.
I meant like some of the hindrances. Where do you start if you were looking to maybe detach from everything? From something,
it's
a place to start.
So when you're meditating and a hindrance arises, is that what you're...
Yes, but also through life in the practice of what you're meditating about.
I'm not quite sure I understand what you're meditating about or why you meditate, you mean?
No, I don't want
to
reason.
Oh, no, I just am trying, I'm trying to understand your question a little better.
If you were to purify yourself, like, you come out of meeting in life where you drank and you sang and you did all that stuff, and you wanted to be a good person.
Yes, right. Mm-hmm.
And that involves purification. Where
5 precepts, the first thing, right? The 5 precepts.
Okay.
So that's a good place. That, and they're not easy. You know, the 5 precepts. Do you take precepts here? The 5 precepts? So the 5 precepts are to not kill, to not steal, to not speak harshly or lie. I mean, I'm abbreviating them, they're longer. To not have, how do they say it, sexual misconduct. Thank you, sexual misconduct. And to not use intoxicants that cloud reason. Now, it's very interesting the way people use that one, because I say, well, you know what? This wine does not cloud my reason. You know, in fact, I think much better when I'm drinking it. No, I mean, it's amazing, because you can get around all... And they're not, these are not rules that are, you know, this is not like you're sinning or something, but they're training precepts. And to just be aware of them is a purification. just to try to be aware of them. I mean, try using only right speech, no gossiping, not saying bad things to somebody, not saying bad things to yourself. That's a lot right there. That's the beginning of a good purification practice. There's many more, but that's really where to begin. Was there a question over here? Yes, I think.
Not so much a question, but I wanted to follow on about the mind seeking matter and going to the unskillful states. I'm real good at unskillful states, and I've been working with a 3-CD set by Pema Chodron, Don't Bite the Hook, undertaking the austerity of patience. And it's 3 CDs long and it's fantastic. I just have it in my car and I listen to it over and over and over again. But she says one of the things that she advises or encourages people to memorize is a very short passage: putting up with little cares, I undertake the training to endure great adversity. She says, so train with traffic jams. And then she goes in this long, extended analogy, drawing it out of how you actually live the training. Mm-hmm. It's something very, very mundane that happens to us all the time. And once you get started, you find all of these little irksome things. She says, don't wait for the great tribulation to come. Just with all of the little things that irk you.
Absolutely. That's how we retrain ourselves. Yes.
One of the things that was transformative for me is, and she said she got it from somebody else, what's going on here? I don't like this.
End of story.
There were 4 things, though. What's going on here? I don't like this.
We'll Google it.
Yeah. End of story.
Oh, nice. Nice. Yeah.
It's like you acknowledge.
Yeah. Good.
This hurts.
Right.
This is unpleasant. It can be an external state. It can be a mind state. Acknowledge. Don't say, oh, well, it's really all okay.
Yeah.
It's not okay. Right?
No, I think that's very important. We're people. Yes, right. Yeah. So the Buddha said, an austerity in this way is not considered a bad thing. It's actually a form of purification. And Buddha said that patience is the highest austerity. If you want to really purify yourself, practice patience. I'm so much more patient than I used to be. And still... I can be so patient, and then my one little trigger thing will happen, and I'm like, whoa, where did that come from? Okay, I was told to end right at 9 o'clock, and I think that's what that clock says, and this one says 9:03, so we're going to go by that one. But so thank you. It's really a pleasure.